Welcome everyone to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 305. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are John Lindemann.
Hey, hey.
Guillaume Veillette.
Yes, Dr. Metz, your nemesis is back.
My frenemy. James could not be with us this week. He's out on travel, and so instead we have our very good old friend, Billy Berghammer.
Old, like old friend, like we used to be friends, or I'm old that I'm old?
I mean that I've known you for about 12 years. That's what I mean.
Well, that's good. Hello. It's good to be back. I've done a lot of Nintendo World Report stuff in, like, the last week.
Crazy. That's part of why I wanted to have you on this week. I thought it was perfect timing because Billy was at PAX last weekend, and he got to play some stuff that most people at PAX did not get to play. So we're going to hear all about that in just a minute. By the way, Guillaume, I hope you aren't going to be intimidated by having three former directors of Nintendo World Report on the show with you. We're going to bore you with managerial histories of the website.
Yeah, we're actually going to strictly talk administration here.
That's right.
Yes. Yep.
That just actually makes editing easier. You just take a large chunk of audio and press delete.
Kind of like you did last week.
It'll be a little bit tougher, though, because you'll have a lot of PowerPoints to go through, you know? A lot of editing. Lots of charts, pie charts especially.
No, actually, we're going to talk about video games. And later in the show, we've got even more action-packed listener mail. Probably not as action-packed as last week, but it will be very interesting nonetheless. And first up, as usual, we're going to do new business. And I thought we'd start out by Billy telling us a little about his PAX experience last weekend and the Nintendo games that you played.
Yeah, it was another PAX Prime. I've never gone to PAX East, and hopefully someday I would like to go to PAX Australia because that sounds amazing. I've been going to PAX Prime for probably the last 3 or 4 years, and Neil didn't have anybody on the West Coast to go to PAX, and nobody's in the Seattle area, so he asked me to cover some stuff. My gut before the show was that there wouldn't be a whole lot of Nintendo stuff, like, new, and there really wasn't. As far as Wii U was concerned, it was all the same E3 builds. Everything that we've seen before was in the same exact shape at PAX Prime. But the 3DS was a lot more, had a lot more new stuff for it. Professor Layton was there, Fluidity, the sequel, Spin Cycle was there, on the show floor, Nintendo had three different areas all around PAX Prime. They had their main booth, which just had the Wii U demos, and it had some of the already released 3DS titles like New Super Mario Bros. 2 and Kid Icarus. And then in this side concourse, where the escalators are, on one floor, on both floors, they just had different 3DS stuff. They also had Kirby for Wii and, really neat historical timeline of Kirby, which you can see pictures that I posted or had somebody else posted on the site. and that was cool. Paper Mario was the big deal. This is the first time it's going to be hands-on with the game. If you remember from E3, they did a demonstration of a level at one of the after hours developer things, and Nate did a great job of demonstrating that on stage. So I was, ready to check this game out. I like the games in the series. I didn't really like the one that was on Wii too much, just because they took out the turn-based battle system. But I was excited for this one because turn-based battles are back, which I really enjoyed from the previous games. But on the floor, unfortunately, it wasn't playable. They just had... It kind of reminded me of, like, the ShamWow demonstration that you go to State Fair and you see, like... So, like, Vince, like, a guy with a microphone be like, hey, this is the new Paper Mario, blah, blah. And there's, like, and he's demonstrating it. For press, it was playable behind closed doors, but unfortunately, it was... just a slice of what they had already shown before. So basically, I got a couple battles, and I got to solve a puzzle which was already solved for me.
And oh my gosh.
That's all that was really there. Now,
but you did get the important info that, in fact, the buttons do stuff, and they work.
Right. I mean, but that's
always key.
Yeah, but it was just, it was kind of silly. Like, I kind of understand that at a trade show or at something like PAX, that demoing an RPG is sort of hard to do.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, fine, let people play the first 5 minutes or give them a 5 minute slice or something like that and kick them off. They've done that before at GDC with, I think it was the new Super Mario Brothers. They only let people play for 5 minutes and they cut them off. This is their last big holiday title. It's a freaking Mario game, and they weren't letting the people play it. Like, it just kind of blew me away that wasn't the case.
Yeah, that is their big holiday 3DS title.
Yeah.
There's everything else has been moved, so yeah. There's nothing. I don't think they intended Paper Mario to be the star of the show, but too bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, granted, New Super Mario Bros. 2 is still their big, big Mario title, but, I mean, that's already out, and this is the last one to go, and I guess I just would have expected them to push it harder, so. Mm. But needless to say, they didn't. I did get to play it, which is the same if you watch that video, which there's a link from my preview. You can watch the whole demo and even more of than what I got to play. But, you know, it feels good. The whole sticker thing, there are stickers everywhere. It's called Sticker Star for a reason. That's what you're using for your power-ups and all of your moves when you're in the turn-based battles, and you choose a sticker from your sticker book, such as a jump or a line jump when you jump down the line of enemies, fire flowers, et cetera, et cetera.
Can you confirm that there are no, like, free regular attacks that, like, to do anything in battle, you have to have a sticker?
Yeah, if you do not have any stickers, you have to run away.
Wow. And did going through this menu to, like, choose your sticker, did it feel like it was pretty fast? Because to me, that sounds like it could potentially really slow down the battle speed.
I mean, your sticker book's on the lower screen, so for the most part, you pick a sticker and then you confirm it, because if you pick the sticker and it launched right into the attack, you wouldn't be able to time your button presses to strengthen the attacks or the blocks. You know what I'm saying? So there's that pause to confirm this is the sticker. You know, say this is I want jump. Yes, that's what I'd like to do. I'd like to jump on that enemy's head. And so then all of a sudden the attack starts, Mario launches in the air, and then when you press A just as he's hitting the enemy's head, or the attack actually connects with the enemy, and then that can strengthen the attack or chain attacks. So,
okay.
But that, you know, unfortunately, I really wish I could say more about that game. I was hoping to see more. Like,
Didn't you say in your impressions that you had to turn off the 3D for some reason?
Yeah, this is the first time I had actually got, one of the first times that I'd got my hand on an XL. So there was a little weird flickeriness to the 3D. My assumption is that this was not a polished build or I was at the wrong angle. Like, I'm not, if anybody does 3D well on the 3DS, it's Nintendo, so I'm not super concerned with that, but it was just something that I noticed.
That's weird because if we assume that it's the same demo that Nate Bildorf was playing at E3, he was commenting on how awesome the 3D looked to him as he was playing it.
Sure, and I'm sure it was. You know, it could have been just the angle that I had it or the distance away from, you know, I had not had any real length. You know, since then I've had a lot more time with an XL because I have one now, but, you know, it was just one of the first times I was sitting down actually playing with an XL. So
sure.
I don't really think it's any cause for concern, so.
Okay, then I have to ask about fluidity, because you know I'm a huge fan of this and had recommended the original to you, and I was very, very surprised that they announced a sequel for 3DS. So what's the deal with Spin Cycle?
Okay, so Spin Cycle, now I never beat the original fluidity. There are a couple things that kind of irritated me with the game, especially when you jumped with your water. I thought that was kind of a problem.
Yeah.
Because you did the flicking, or not flicking, but you're holding the Wiimote like like an NES pad, and you have to shake it, kind of like Donkey Kong Country, to jump. And I think that is really stupid. And it didn't always feel really good to me. It never felt like a good instead of use. I'd rather just have buttons, you know. Yeah.
I got used to it, but that is the worst thing about fluidity, mm-hmm. for sure. And I understand why it turns people off, but I also think it's worth trying to get used to it and get over that, because the rest of the game is so fucking awesome.
Sure. And the other thing that bothered me was you had to hold the Wiimote in a specific way to get the tilt action to work every time. And I also, you know, just the way the game was laid out, it was very easy to get lost or you had to scour to find the next available door or the next available, your goal to where you wanted to go next. And
yeah, some of them were like down, across, and around. And you had to,
yeah, it was just very, very compressed.
It's
and
weirdly
so, yeah.
old school like that, because it doesn't, yeah, the level design is very dense, but it doesn't give you any kind of direction. It never really points you, hey, go over here to find the next major thing that you need to do in order to progress. And it sort of just leaves it to you to explore and like rule out all the other possibilities.
Right. So far, what I've noticed about Spin Cycle is they've kind of refined everything that my gut tells me is they learned a lot from the community, and they've gone back to the drawing board and kind of refined a lot of these things. Jumping is by pressing both shoulder buttons. Awesome.
Good.
That works fine.
Yeah.
Just because you hold the 3DS in a certain way, that orientation problem that I had with the Wiimote is gone, because you're holding it, you know, there's no way to weirdly twist it, I guess. And thirdly, it seems like the level design is going to be more linear. There's no exploring, just randomly you're going from point A to point B. There will be replayability of levels, just in case you miss something, or if there's a puzzle piece you miss, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, a lot of the same rules apply. You're trying to save these rainbow spirits or whatever, and to give life to this book. Now, the book, I think, this time around looks a lot more vivid. It's got this kind of classic storybook feel to it. Levels aren't just like based around, you know, hitting switches that it's not as mechanical this time, at least. The first levels that I played were a lot more organic. So you're in like a jungle and or a forest, and you're moving your water over things like dinosaurs or dinosaur bones, or it had a lot more life to it. It didn't feel as, I guess, sterile as the original fluidity did. So, and it looks great on the 3DS. The demo unit that I was playing with, was the XL. There is no 3D anymore. They decided to pull the 3D out, but that's because of why it's called Spin Cycle, because there's water. You're moving your water through canals that go upside down into loops. So to do that, you rotate your 3DS. You can rotate your 3DS in 360 degrees. Now, that being said, that felt really bizarre and wonky to me. So what I did was I just tilted the 3DS down. And with the angle of the 3DS screen, I could still see what was going on, so I didn't have to actually spin the frickin' 3DS, because that just doesn't seem
so. You're
smart.
Saying instead of spinning it in your hand so that the screen was upside down, you just tilted the whole system forward?
Yeah, forward and down.
Okay. So then the gyro would still detect that it's upside down, but correct. You're not holding the whole thing backwards anymore,
right.
like you would be if you just spun it.
And that seemed to work just fine.
Okay, well, that's good.
You know, it just seemed like a much more refined version of fluidity, and I think that's so. You know, what I played, I liked it. It also seemed the first fluidity seemed to ramp up its difficulty like right from the get go, and this one seemed to add new features or new things a lot slower. So I think that'll be nice. And I think also, since it's a portable game, having the levels more linear and not having to search all over for the next thing you're supposed to do will make the game a lot more bite-sized and better for portable gaming.
That's so. Probably true. I love the exploration though in the first one. I hope at least within this more linear level structure, I hope there's still some exploration within each smaller level.
Well, and there are secrets. You know, you still have to get those puzzle pieces, and those will. The girl didn't tell me what they were for, but I'm assuming it's the same thing as the original, that they just build out new levels. So.
And you had mini games as well, unlockable mini games.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I think all that'll be will pretty much stay the same. You know, I hope they rework the story a little bit so games like that can stand out a little bit more, but I thought it was pretty cool. It was really ridiculous at PAX because I was looking, you know how they have the little 3DS setups and they've got the little placard that says, "Oh, this is Kid Icarus or this is Mario Kart." All they had was it was eShop. So I didn't know where it was, and fortunately I just went up because everybody was at every other booth, but the eShop, nobody was at because everybody was like, really, why am I going to a shop station? So I went up there because that was the first time I was going to touch an XL for the first time. And sure enough, she's like, well, do you want to play Kirby? I'm like, no, that's cool. You know, and she's like, well, how about Fluidity? I'm like, here it is. Thank you. Guys might want to tell people this, you know, it just sucks that it, you know, I don't know, but it kind of bothered me that it was kind of buried. And
so you're probably one of the few people who actually played it, especially among the media. I mean, if they weren't like literally offering it to you and saying, hey, do you want to play Fluidity? Then most people probably were not on the lookout for that game.
Yeah, and it's pretty good. And it will be apparently, I mean, they were saying TBD, but my sources tell me it'll be up before the end of the year, so at least we'll have that.
Yeah, it was on that big release date list that they put out a couple weeks ago.
And oh, okay. I believe that a guy from Curve Studios congratulated on Twitter his team for finishing on time and everything, and passing certification. So it must be very, very, very far along.
If it's past cert, then it's done.
Yeah.
It's in the bag.
Awesome.
It's pretty good. I think, Johnny, I think you're going to dig it. So.
Yeah, I think I will too.
It's made me go back to the original Fluidity.
Oh, good.
Nice.
So
stick it out, man. That is a very rewarding game.
But outside of that, the only other things that I really played at PAX Nintendo-wise was I never really played any of the Nintendo Land stuff at E3. So I just kind of, it was there. I was behind closed doors with some people that I knew and decided to play. And I think it's really going to be a lot of fun. I played the Luigi's Mansion and Animal Crossing mini games, which Luigi's Mansion is basically the same game they had last year with a new skin. And Animal Crossing was fun too. I don't personally see this taking off and exploding like Wii Sports did. I do not see old people like this sort of stuff like they did with bowling and other mini games from Wii Sports. Like,
right.
I think people that bought a Wii that have all those nostalgic feelings, I think they could get into it. I hope this is a pack-in. I really do. I don't see this being or deserving a $60 price tag unless there is a lot more really awesome features that we're going to learn about next week. So,
well, don't you think that part of the appeal of Wii Sports for non-gamers, for people who didn't already play video games, is that it looked kind of generic and it didn't reference a culture that they weren't familiar with?
Yes, and I also think it's also because you didn't have to tell somebody how to play.
It's like they know, like, they've already.
You don't have to
know
tell
how to
somebody how to play tennis or golf.
Know?
Yeah. So this you're going to have to explain. Like, just like Nintendo wasted precious time during their press conference to explain a freaking minigame to people. Like,
but am I the only one with a dad who had to, you know, some trouble grasping the controls for Wii Bowling? When to release the buttons. And
I had the same thing, but for the most part, they still know the general principles behind those sports.
They won't get intimidated by it, you know, whereas, it's like, how are you supposed to, you know, explain, like, party games to them? Like, they're like, Mario Party. No one knows what the heck Mario Party is about that doesn't actually already know what Mario Party is about.
I think Nintendo Land is definitely more complex, and for that reason, it's more interesting to me than Wii Sports was. But I agree with Billy. I think it's also going to reduce its super mainstream appeal.
the simplicity of the Wiimote, there's only technically two buttons outside of the one and two and plus and minus, but there's only really two buttons that you use. You put the Wii Pad in front of somebody, or the Wii U Pad in front of somebody, they're going to be like, ugh. Yeah. It's basically a 360 controller with a giant touchscreen that makes it even more complicated. So, in theory, you know, for those, for the electronically challenged individuals in all of our lives, that will scare the crap out of them.
Maybe some third-party hardware maker will release a fake bezel, like a giant black bezel that you can just put as a frame around the gamepad and give it to someone and just make them think it's a really ugly
like
iPad.
Like gamepad blue blockers?
I'm sure. I'm sure Nyko's had it. Nyko's going to be on top of that or somebody. But, I played the games. I think they're going to be fun. Do I see myself spending $60 on that instead of putting $60 towards, like, Pikmin? No, I don't. I've played my fair share of party games, you know, and I'm looking forward to next week when we actually get some real details on what's going to be there at launch, which most of the stuff that we've already seen is going to be at launch. But, you know, prices and how it all works. Yeah. So, but outside of that at PAX, outside of panels, there weren't, you know, I didn't waste my time on any of, like, the AAA games like Assassin's Creed or Borderlands 2 because I know I'm going to buy those games. So, I didn't want to spend any time there, but I did spend a lot of time in the PAX 10 and in the super mega indie booth area just to see what those guys have cooking. And I always find that stuff really fascinating, and all the developers are there on hand to show you stuff. I saw the two new 3DS, or what was the new fighting game that Nicholas is going to be releasing for?
Oh, yeah. Like Yagaterasu or something like that. Like, it's an eShop fighting game for 3DS and PC.
Right, but they haven't announced what the name's going to be when they bring it over here, but Nicholas is a good... They have a kind of a knack of picking out these, you know, smaller sort of indie titles or weird, quirky Japanese titles and bringing them over stateside. So it looked pretty good, but they didn't have it running on 3DS. It was actually... I think it was just running on PC and they had fighting sticks. But, you know, for a download fighter, you know, if you're sick of Street Fighter, it might be a good opportunity for that. I think you'll be seeing more about that game on Nintendo World Report soon. So, but yeah, for the most part, that's kind of what I came away from, you know, PAX. I think it was a weird one this year because we are so close to not only the Wii U coming out, but it's at the end of the generation for PS3 and 360. So... Nobody was really taking a big chance on debuting anything really major at the show. So, but it's awesome. I you know, if you've never been to a PAX, and I know you guys do a podcast there, and it's awesome. Like, I wish I could go to all of them. Like, the vibe is so different from something like E3.
Yeah.
When we go to something like E3, I always come out of it just completely, like, drained and spent. When I go to PAX, I come out, like, rejuvenated and, like, excited about the industry and what's next, and it's really a lot of fun. Plus, it's like one of the only places I can ever street pass like a madman, so it's pretty cool. So if you ever get a chance to go, it's awesome.
Did you notice any panels that were Nintendo focused?
Nope.
I wonder if we still have the monopoly on that. I mean, between us and connectivity, which started this year at PAX East. So this is making me feel like I really want to have a panel at PAX Prime also.
To be honest, and I know a lot of the guys at Penny Arcade fairly well, and I know that there were a lot of panels this year that actually got turned away.
Yeah.
So, and bigger, higher profile ones than you'd think, not just like some, you know, some tiny thing. You know, I would love to see you guys at PAX Prime. I think, you know, I'd love to hear what the difference is between the two, if there's any difference in the vibe of it.
I've heard they're pretty much the same, but the problem is, I mean, for me, Seattle and Boston are about equidistant, so it's not really a problem for me, but for James and John and Guillaume, they're all on the East Coast.
Right, right.
So it's just a lot harder for them to get out there.
So, listeners, please look at the t-shirts that we sell on the website.
Yes, thank you.
Nice plug, Guillaume.
Thank you. That actually would help if we sold a ton of t-shirts.
Yep.
That would probably help a little bit, but I mean, it would help anyway. But if we actually, like, if that shit blew up, then we could probably justify, you know, doing something special and trying to go out there. Because then we can go out there and sell even more t-shirts at the show.
How was the excitement around the Wii U? Like, were people lining up for it, or was there kind of, you know, apathy?
It seemed like people were lining up for it. It didn't seem to be, you know, it wasn't like a typical E3 line where it wraps around the booth 15 times and, you know, they cut it off. Like, if you wanted to go in and play something, you probably had to wait four or five people, I think. Like, I'm trying to...
Yeah, it sounds kind of like the 3DS booth was at PAX East this year, where, you know, it was continuously packed, but if you just kind of waited around and, you know, kept your eyes open, you'd be on a 3DS reasonably quickly.
There were a lot of people watching Paper Mario. There were a lot of, you know, people in Nintendo's main booth. You know, there's definitely people in there playing their stuff, you know. I did not ask anybody what their thoughts on it were, you know, but, you know, it seemed like their booth was fairly crowded all the time, anytime that I was around it, so.
Cool. Well, that's good.
You know, I think everybody's just waiting to find out what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for the report, man.
Sure.
So Guillaume is going to be next with new business.
All right. Well, I've been waiting for a while to talk about this game that I finished maybe 2 weeks ago. I've been playing Monster World 4. And I've been trying to convince people to actually play it, but unfortunately, this game never released in the West. It's a Genesis game. It was released on the Virtual Console recently, this summer, I mean. And, at the same time, it was also released on XBLA and PSN. So there's really no excuse not to, like, it's very, very easily accessible now. And Sega has translated it for the first time.
So it got the Sin and Punishment treatment.
Yes. And it is a very high-quality, old-school game. It's one of those gems that people probably should have played back in the day and, you know, probably would have loved it if they had had the opportunity, but sadly, it never got over here. Like, you know, like kind of the same as Rondo of Blood. Very high-quality game. People would have dug it.
I remember way back in the day, I was like, wow, those games look really good, but it just seemed like I either never had the console they were on or whatever. It's just...
Which is surprising because they actually came out on, you know, like Genesis and...
Yeah.
Turbo Graphics, I think, both of them, like different names or different versions, but so the developer that made it, Westone, had basically the rights to their game design, but then Sega had the rights for Wonder Boy, so they would take their game, put a new skin on it, and call it Adventure Island, or would call it, you know, it's like Dragon Boy, or I can't, you know,
Dragon's Curse, I think, is one of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, the series is super confusing. And that's part of the reason nobody played it, I think, is the branding is so confusing. I mean, Guillaume, is this your first Monster World game?
It is. I did play the first Wonder Boy, which is basically the equivalent of Adventure Island.
There's also Wonder Boy in Monster World. That was on, I think, the Sega Master System, I think.
Yes. Okay. Let's... The series is very convoluted, and we get into things like Wonder Boy 3, Monster World, Wonder Boy 4, yeah. Monster World 2.
Super Mario Advance 4, Super Mario 3.
Exactly. So yeah, like it's convoluted, but I skipped right to Monster World 4 after the first Wonder Boy, which was very different anyway. This has nothing to do with Adventure Island. Like, this is not a platformer. It is an adventure game. You play as a different hero this time. You play as a girl who, you know, leaves her village to go save the world, I suppose. It's not very original, but the story is still very charming, very well done. And it's a side-scrolling, action-adventure game. So I think there is a very strong resemblance with Adventure of Link. There's the same kind of she shares a couple of moves with Link, including the famous downward thrust. Yeah, like it's that kind of game. And as you kill monsters, you get money, which you buy armor with, and you go into dungeons. And the dungeons are actually one of the things that really surprised me about it. It's only got four dungeons, but each of them are really, really different. Like, they each have their own hook. Let's say maybe, like, the third dungeon is very, very puzzle-oriented. And when I say puzzle, I don't mean, like, grab the key, find the door. I mean Professor Layton kind of puzzle.
Really?
Now, are these all side-scrolling, or does it change the camera view when you go in?
No, you never have an overhead view. You basically travel, you know, always side-scrolling to the first town, and then from the first town, you have access to the four different worlds. You access portals that send you to the dungeons. And yeah, like as I said, the third dungeon will have like a puzzle such as like you find six statues and then you'll find different clues. Like the turtle and the witch statues don't go near each other. And the leopard statue goes to the right of the raven statue. And from, you know, limited clues, you'll have to find that, figure out in what order to put them on pedestals to open the door. So, like, I'm pretty sure actually I solved this exact same riddle in Professor Layton. So, you know, and the fourth dungeon was something then completely different. And it had springs and spikes and very, very fast-paced and very, very platforming heavy. So, like, there was a nice variety there, you know, not just in terms of visuals, but also in terms of gameplay.
Now, according to Wikipedia, this was originally released in Japan for the Genesis in 1994. So that makes this a really late Genesis game, right before the Saturn came out. Does it feel like really advanced? You know, like, does it feel like a really polished, nice Genesis game?
I'm not a huge Sega fan. I usually find, especially their arcade ports, but it seemed to me, like when you grab a Sega collection, it always seems to be arcade ports. And I don't really find the kind of games I like on those collections. But this is a pure console game. It feels designed for consoles. It's, you know, like it's meaty, it's varied, it's lengthy, and it does feel like it's made by a team that really understands the Genesis hardware. And if you listen to the last radio trivia, you could hear some of the songs. They're really, really good. The sound quality is you know, irreproachable, and the graphics are so colorful for a Genesis game. It really feels, you know, like the colors pop out at you, and the animations are really cute and charming.
Would you say it looks a little like Shantae?
I did make that comparison on the Radio Trivia. Perhaps it's not as lovingly animated as Shantae, but it definitely has that kind of vibe. Maybe, you know, and not just because the heroine is a woman, but also because you have the same mechanic of going in the foreground and the background in the main village. So it's exactly like the DSiWare game. And, you know, like this is exactly what Nintendo fans would enjoy so much. You know, it's a shame that it never came here, but it's also a shame that it was never a Nintendo system, because like this is the kind of game that I think we used to thrive on back in the day.
Yeah, it sounds a lot more like something that you would have typically found on Super Nintendo versus Genesis.
Yeah, I would say so.
It's been on my watch list for a while, and based on your recommendation, I'm going to have to pick this up very, very soon. I mean, this is exactly what I want from Virtual Console releases. Something awesome that I have maybe heard of, or that I can easily be sold on, by recommendations, that I just never got to play back in the day, and I never would have gotten to play any other way than Virtual Console. And it sounds like my kind of game. So,
yeah.
Awesome.
Like, not only, you know, I don't think that its reputation has been blown out of proportion just because it was inaccessible before. It really is a genuinely good adventure game that I think very modern, that you can still enjoy today.
Cool.
And since then, I've been kind of slowing down a bit. You know, like before, once I beat Monster World 4, that was basically like the sixth game in a week that I was beating.
Holy shit.
Well, I was, you know, like small bite-sized downloadable games for the most part. But still, like afterwards, I slowed down. I was kind of in a post-great game funk, you know, like,
what's going to top this? Nothing.
Yeah. So I've been going back, digging into my backlog, and I decided to finally finish Hotel Dusk. My previous save file was from 2007.
That sounds like me.
And I gave up.
Good Lord.
Yeah, yeah. And I gave up very early in that game.
Lindy, you're still reviewing that game, I'm assuming, right?
As a matter of fact.
It was interrupted by Spiderwick Chronicles, and he forgot to go back to it.
I do like adventure games, but I realized why I gave up so quickly on it. It does not do any of the things that I usually play adventure games for. I'm a huge LucasArts fan, so, and I think that what keeps me going most of the time in those games, like Grim Fandango or Maniac Mansion, is the humor. And not just, you know, the dialogue, but also when it, like, you could try anything while you're solving puzzles, you can almost always count on something funny being said, your characters saying something stupid or calling you stupid for in a funny way.
Even if you fail, or maybe especially if you fail.
Yeah. So whatever you do in those games, you're usually entertained. So I don't mind the puzzles all that much, even if they're obtuse. You can try everything and not really get bored. But in Hotel Dusk, it's a different, completely different kind of vibe. It's very serious, you play as this former cop, you know, still looking for his former partner who double-crossed him, something like that. But it's not, the unfortunate thing is that, like, while I think I could enjoy a kind of grittier, more serious adventure game, it's also not, so far, a very well-done one. The mystery doesn't seem to get interesting until very far in the game. And initially, early in the game, the guy describes himself as someone who finds things. Like, I'm not making this up. He's just like, yes, like, I'm a door-to-door salesman, and also for my boss, I find things.
It sounds very Japanese.
Yeah, well, you know, in every freaking adventure game, you find things. Please find another motivation for your character. You know, let me
that be. That should be one of the box quotes or the bullet points on the back of the box. Hey, in this game, you find things.
It just struck me as so lazy. Like, please let me be like a wannabe pirate or travel agent of the dead or, you know, something cool, not someone who finds things. And it very much feels like that's what all what you're doing in Hotel Dusk so far. You poke around, you find stuff for the other guests in this hotel, and I guess you learn to get to know them better and, you know, try to find, you know, why are they there and, you know, what's their story. But none of it so far is really engaging.
Is the dialogue, like when you talk to other characters, is it interactive at all?
Usually you just ask a string of questions. Like the questions will pop out naturally as you talk to them, and you have basically no choice but to go through those questions. Except some questions will actually, you know, bite you in the ass. Like, you can have a game over screen in this game. Let's say you just poked around the hotel owner's private office, and you found some info, and then immediately, like, he kind of stumbles upon you just as you exit. And then you ask him, like, you know, why, you know, what's so special about December, you know, 23rd, after you saw that date circled on his calendar on his desk? He's going to be like, hey, you know, like, have you been looking at my stuff? Get out of here.
He's going to be like, hey, don't you celebrate Hanukkah?
It's not terribly engaging. I would say I was not actually a huge fan of 999. But the mystery, the intrigue of 999 was so much better than what I'm seeing so far in Hotel Dusk that I really have to recommend it over it. And there's just about as much gameplay in both titles.
Interesting. I know a lot of Nintendo fans who really love Hotel Dusk, and it performed fairly well, I want to say, in a couple of retroactive polls way back in the day.
Yeah.
And I've never played it, and I've always been curious to try it, but it's good to hear the other side as well, somebody who disagrees on it.
It's not surprising that playing it initially, like, people would have loved it, because the DS was still kind of proving itself, and a lot of the puzzles are of the let's use these functionalities, you know, type of design.
Okay.
So you will poke around on the touchscreen, you will you know, blow on the mic, you will do all those things, and I or you will close the lid of the DS to solve this puzzle. So, you know, like a lot of novel stuff like that, you know, in 2012 is not so novel.
All right. So, John, why don't you tell us about what you've been playing?
Well, my PSP backlog sort of, you know, trolling continues. As you know, I was traveling pretty much all last week, so the PSP has been kind of my go-to on the road. So one of the games I have been looking at that I've had for a long time is Monster Hunter Freedom Unite. Now, what's interesting about this is I decided to pick it back up because I never really put much time into it. Surprise, surprise. But what's interesting about it is that, you know, I had pretty much dismissed really getting into it because, you know, it has a very high learning curve, especially on the PSP because of all the wonky camera controls, right? You have to constantly manage the camera. But what I found is that when I actually did pick it back up, Monster Hunter Tri, it's interesting because playing Monster Hunter Tri on Wii pretty much taught me how to play that series. I could not learn it. It was just impossible to learn on PSP. I just...
So you've cracked the code.
I have cracked the code, and I realize this, and...
I have not.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, like Monster Hunter Tri, because Monster Hunter Tri, actually, it did have, you know, a fairly decent tutorial that kind of showed you what to do. But you had to put your time in. You know, you had to spend a couple of hours and actually play through it until you got it. Then once you got it, it's like Monster Hunter Freedom Unite plays exactly the same way, obviously. It's another Monster Hunter game. But, I mean, really, it's very, very similar. You know... Like, once I figured, and it was kind of embarrassing for me to go in there and just realize, like, how much time I had spent with the game and how little I had actually done. Because on my game save file, I had something like 12 hours. And it's like, I still pretty much had all the starting armor. I hadn't done any quests. And so I was just like, what the hell was I doing with this game? I don't even know what I was doing for 12 hours in this game because I hadn't accomplished anything. Because, you know...
12 hours is more than I put into most games I play. So that's nothing to sneeze at. But yeah, if you go back to it, you're like, man,
yeah,
what a waste.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's like that's the thing. It's like, you know, there's only a certain number of things you can really do in any Monster Hunter game. It's like, you know, you go out and complete quests and, you know, you get stuff and craft armor and you craft your swords. And, you know, there's like certain things that you can grow that you can, you know, make potions with. But it's a very limited kind of amount of things that you can do. Everything is pretty much geared to, you know, gearing yourself up so you can, you know, fight better monsters. And I really hadn't done any of that. And like, I didn't get the concept of, you know, the farming and mining and stuff like that. Just all of these things that, you know, now are kind of, I know from playing Monster Hunter Tri, like kind of where they fit into the game. And so it was very easy for me to just pick it up and kind of like, just kind of, you know, determine what I needed to do and kind of knock out all these tasks. So it was very interesting. So I credit Monster Hunter Tri for kind of showing me like exactly how to play the game. But it really, really gets me hyped for Monster Hunter 4. That's going to be really, really good.
Yeah, I was about to ask.
Yeah, I mean, so. Because like, one of the things that sucks about the PSP game, and you know, that's the thing, like now that I kind of learned that I know how to play it, I can manage the camera. Like, I get it. You know, just, you know, it's kind of one of those things you learn to just always keep the monster that you're fighting in front of you and, you know, this, all that kind of thing. And so you sort of learn instinctively how to kind of operate the camera and make it work for you. Far from ideal. I mean, it's goofy just like any other action game on PSP that tries to kind of do the dual analog thing by using the D-pad to control the camera. It's just, it's not ideal and you have to make it work. It doesn't really work out of the box. But with Monster Hunter 4, I mean, I'm assuming they're going to support the Circle Pad Pro, and that's just going to be amazing. I mean, it's going to be Monster Hunter Tri, but I think it'll even be better, actually, than Monster Hunter Tri, because I think it'll be great to be able to, you know, play a game like that on the go. You know, just kind of hook up to, you know, a Wi-Fi access point, see who's online. You know, which is great about the 3DS. You can always see who else is online and just hop in because I think it's really going to be what a lot of people have wanted Monster Hunter games to be. Especially the portable aspect of it is going to be really, really huge because, you know, it's perfect for, you know, hopping on, kind of doing a quest, getting some, you know, getting a team and just going out, doing one quest and then hopping off. So I think it'll be really good. So really it just kind of whets my appetite for Monster Hunter 4. So...
Have they announced whether or not Monster Hunter 4 is going to be Wi-Fi compatible? Because Monster Hunter portably, at least for in Japan or the Freedom Unite series, has never been really online unless you use like that PlayStation ad hoc ghetto.
Yeah, which is just
thing. It's always been local wireless.
Yes. Right, right, right.
Yep.
And I know in Japan it's huge. They have little cafes that people just go there and there's tables and they just go and play. And
apparently they're called Monster McDonald's.
Well, no,
that's what the Famicast guys say.
Well, I've been to stores like, because you know there's giant towers, skyscrapers and whatever. So you go to certain. We got off on the wrong floor, and we walked in and we're like, "What the hell is this?" And it's just tables and dudes sitting around playing Monster Hunter. But
that's awesome.
As far as Circle Pad Pro, I mean, that's when they last year at Tokyo Game Show, when I was there, that was what they were. That was the first time you could get your hands on Circle Pad Pro, and it's for. I mean. I think one of the main reasons why they're releasing it is for Monster Hunter. Anyway,
yeah.
Oh,
so.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But I hope it is online. I really do because, in Japan it's one thing. It's a lot easier to play games like Monster Hunter in groups. But, for someone like me or you, John, is that, we're older, so the chances one of our friends is playing Monster Hunter on the 3DS is going to be... it's few and far between, so...
Well, they are going to bring 4 to America, to the West in general, I should say. And I think when they do that, if it doesn't already have online, they're going to have to add it. I mean, if they really want to sell this in the West, because Monster Hunter Tri was a surprise sort of sleeper hit for Capcom in the West, but that's mainly because of the online play.
Regardless of how janky that online was, man, seriously, sure. If you tried that WeSpeak bullshit,
yeah, that was
like,
awful.
That thing.
Yeah, that was my baptism, WeSpeak baptism, and it was, I felt miserable the whole time. I could not understand what other people were saying.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like they could understand me.
It cuts off between when you're loading new areas, and that happens a lot
in Monster
Hunter.
It does. Yep.
So what everybody did was they just used Xbox Live or Skype. I don't know, but that's my concern about online for the 3DS. It's like, that's cool, but there's most likely not going to be any voice communication.
I think
so...
there will be. I mean, Heroes of Ruin has
That was my question. I mean, I've never tried the voice chat on Heroes of Ruin, but I've heard it's pretty good.
Yeah, I've heard pretty good things. I mean, that's the 3DS is so self-contained.
Yeah.
That you don't really have to deal with crap like WeSpeak and whether it's going to be supported or how well it's going to be supported. Pokemon has voice chat, so I think there's a very good chance that they'll go with that. I mean, first they have to do online play. They're not going to do voice chat. They might do video chat without online play like Pokemon did, but they're not going to do voice chat without online.
Yeah.
But I think they'll go that extra mile with it. If they're going to bother to do it, they're going to do it right.
Yep.
They did it with Tri. So
I hope so. I mean, I'm really looking forward to it. And, even playing this game, I mean, it's several years old now. It still has that kind of hook,
Well, from what we've seen, Monster Hunter 4 actually looks really good. It looks like a big improvement over 3.
Yep.
And it's going to be shown at TGS in a few weeks from now, and it's going to be playable. So, hopefully we'll hear more about it and see some video. But I've heard it's very impressive. And also... based on the 3DS version of 3 that is only in Japan, apparently that game, the 3D effect is fantastic. So I think we can probably look forward to really, really good 3D in a Monster Hunter 4 as well.
I hope so, and that'd be really cool. I mean, that would really work well in Monster Hunter because half the time you have this huge monster running right into your face. So I think it'd be really neat.
Cool. All right. Well, I'll go next and finish up new business here. So I wanted to talk about Wario Land. Because I started playing this as soon as I got my XL and I had access to the eShop again, one of the very first things I did was download Wario Land because it was a game that I'd played a little bit here and there when I was a kid. I played it on my friend's Game Boys, but I never really got to spend much time with it. And knowing that I love Wario Land 2 and 3 and have a lot of respect for 4 as well, which we did on our last Retroactive, I really wanted to actually finally play all the way through the first original black and white Wario Land. And so I've been playing it for a while, and I was actually sort of playing it at the same time that I was playing Wario Land 4 for the show, because I wanted to sort of compare them. And, I know a lot of people say that the original Wario Land is really slow and doesn't have that much in common with the later games, but I think that's overstating the differences. I think there's a very clear progression, and I think Wario Land as a series of platforms has always been pretty sophisticated. they expect a lot of the player to find secrets and to explore and to experiment and to try different things. And I expected that to be lacking from the first game, and it's not. The original Wario Land is very clever, and it's not that hard to just play straight through, but to actually find some of the secrets and do some of the really cool stuff in the game, there's some really interesting kind of secret places and very tricky things that you have to do. You know, the mechanic of the game is that Wario, it's somewhere between a Mario game and the later Wario games, in that you sort of transform, but you transform by getting these hats, which are similar to the power-ups in a 2D Mario game. But the hats let you do things like breathe fire from a dragon head, or butt stomp, or like fly through the air on a jetpack, which I love, of course. And the great thing about these powers is that you really have to learn what they can and cannot do. Like, if you get the jetpack, you can't butt stomp anymore. And that may mean that you can't get to a secret place. So in some cases, you might see a power-up that is like, maybe it's your favorite, or maybe it feels like it would be an upgrade over whatever you've currently got. And you have to look at the level and kind of like discern whether that's put there as sort of a decoy to screw you up. Because sometimes they'll give you like really cool power-ups that are actually the opposite of what you need in that level. And so you have to intentionally avoid them. And that is just a really cool kind of strategic way to do a platformer that I wasn't expecting from such an old Game Boy game. There's also I was also really impressed by the technology of the game, because, you know, although this is black and white and it looks pretty crude, you know, when you first look at it, I think, you know, in reality, this is actually a fairly late Game Boy game. And this came out in like 93 or 94, maybe. So it's actually not that long even before Game Boy Color. Because I think Wario Land 2 came out like a year before Game Boy Color. So it was a really late Game Boy game. And Wario Land has a lot of actually really impressive technology. There's no slowdown. There's no flickering. There's no weird clipping and shit like that. You used to get in a lot of Game Boy games. Even the previous Mario Land, you know, like Super Mario Land is buggy as hell. It's really glitchy and bizarre. And, you know, sometimes you pause the game and Mario disappears. It does a lot of really strange stuff. And Wario Land feels much more cohesive. And one of the cool things is that, you know, because the game is designed to be kind of explorative, you know, so you're not necessarily just going straight through the level. Sometimes you're kind of looking for nooks and crannies. You're going up and then back down. And so it's not like the levels are forced scrolling or anything. You can really just kind of go anywhere you want to within the level. And I was surprised that, like, if you kill an enemy and then go wander off and then come back, the enemy's still dead. Or if you break a block and then you wander off and come back, the block is still gone. So there's a level of persistence in this game that you would expect from a modern game, but not necessarily from a game that looks as old as this one. And that's not just trivial either. It really does kind of play into the game. I mean, there are things like, you know, I remember, I found one of these super secret treasure chests that hold the main treasures of the game that are, some of them are very, very hard to find. Yep. And they're totally optional, but they're the best part of the game, trying to find these things. Just like in Shake It, you know, trying to find the treasure chest is like, that's the real way to play the game. That's when you're going to have the most fun, is if you actually go on that quest. Well, it's the same in the original Wario Land. And I found this chest, and I found the door to the chest. It's this super, you know, big skull door that's really obvious that this is an important place. And you have to have a key to get into it. And I was really stumped because I searched all the immediate area and there definitely was no key around there. And I'm like, crap, what's going on here? And I basically gave up and I just went on through the level. And then like two or three screens later, after going through doorways and a bunch of enemies and platforms and everything, then I found the key and I was amazed. I thought, does this go to a different door? No, it goes to the one I saw before. You have to pick up the key and carry it like halfway back through the level, through all these doorways and all these different challenges, to take it to the door. And I was just surprised that a Game Boy game could even pull off that level of persistence in a level like that. And these are just really surprisingly complicated levels for an old 2D platformer. And I thought it was fantastic. I really had a great, great time playing it.
I gotta say, as a Game Boy owner, and like I didn't have an NES as a kid, and
this is more advanced than almost any NES game I've ever played.
I would say, in some ways, it's more advanced than even Super Mario World. When I was playing the first two Super Mario Lands, I would look enviously at Mario 3 or Mario World, and you know, like sure, like Mario Land 2 looked pretty good, but the rabbit ears were never really as cool as the cape, or you didn't have Yoshi, things like that. But Wario Land, like there's that like technical kind of, it's technically advanced, but there's also in the design, you've got, the world map that has, there are events that you can trigger that will affect the world map and the levels within them.
That's awesome.
And, yeah, and in some cases, that's the only way that you'll find a treasure chest, for instance. Like, you'll open up a new path, and...
It's so replayable. That's the crazy thing. I mean, you know, we all kind of joke about Super Mario Land being about, what, 90 minutes long? Maybe even less. I know a lot of people can beat that game in under an hour. Right. And there's a couple of, like, neat little secrets where you can find 1-ups, but that game is pretty shallow. And it's great. I like Super Mario Land a lot, but... It's like, man, I don't know that this is really worth $5 on the eShop, much less 30 or whatever they charged for it back in 1989. But you go and play a game like Wario Land, and this really feels like a very deep, full-featured game that you can spend a lot of time exploring long after you beat it. And that's really what I want out of a platformer, and especially that's what I expect out of a Wario Land game. And I'm just amazed that they pulled it off in the very first attempt. It's awesome. So the other game I want to talk about this week is also very awesome. It's Ys the Oath in Fel'Ghana. I'd heard many recommendations for this, and so during the last Steam sale, I picked it up for like really cheap. I think $5, maybe even less than that. And it's worth so much more. It is a really fantastic game, and I think virtually everyone listening to this would probably enjoy this game because it's straight up, it's like a really crazy twisted version of like an old Zelda game. It reminds me a lot of Link to the Past. It's more advanced than that. It's almost like it's like two or three sequels down the line from A Link to the Past, just in the way it plays. It doesn't have all these puzzles like a Zelda game, but the action, the feel of it. Another good example would be like Secret of Mana. It's probably a lot closer to that because you have experience points and you're equipping different armor and stuff like that. And the whole game, it's just this, it's not isometric, but it's this sort of like maybe kind of bird's eye view a little bit of these characters. They're really beautifully rendered. The game looks fantastic. And the levels are, you're running around, you got a sword, you attack really fast, the combat is really super fast, kind of like Muramasa or Dust that we've talked about recently. But it just has that feel of immediacy, like combat never feels like a chore because you're just kind of plowing through enemies all the time. And it's not always easy, but it always feels like what you're doing has a real effect on the enemies. And so it doesn't feel like you're just bouncing off of them or that you're really stuck on an enemy. And there's also a lot of really good platforming. And I didn't think there would be at first, because when you start out, your character is a little bit slow and you can jump, but the jumps, there doesn't seem to be a lot to it. It doesn't seem like you really need to jump that much. And as you get farther in the game, you get more and more abilities. So you start to get the ability to dash, and then you get a double jump, and then you get this move that lets you do kind of a helicopter spin and go out farther like Rayman. And all of a sudden, this game is like one of my favorite platformers that I played in a long time. And it really feels different than other platformers because it's so fast paced and because the combat is so good. It's really great. I'd say the whole thing is probably like maybe 10 or 12 hours. So it's really approachable and digestible. It's very fast paced. Man, I'm loving this. I mean, so Oath in Fel'Ghana is a remake of Ys 3, which is one of the only Ys games that ever came to a Nintendo console. And when I was
and it's kind of much maligned. I think it was side scrolling, and people didn't enjoy that.
It was side scrolling, which it was the only game in the series to ever be side scrolling. And yeah, fans of Ys hate Ys 3. Now as a kid, it was the first Ys game that I'd ever played. I had no idea what Ys even was. And it was just one of those Super Nintendo games that my local rental store had, and I glossed over it 100 times because I had no idea what it was. And finally, when I'd played everything else and I really just decided to take a risk and just try something, I rented it, and me and my buddy, like, basically, you know, like, went over and stayed at his house and basically played it till like 4 a.m. eating Hot Pockets and drinking Dr. Pepper, and we loved it. So I got nothing bad to say about Ys 3. I mean, I'd never played anything quite like it. I thought it was great. It's almost like a weird sequel to Zelda 2, you know, because it is side scrolling. So there's platforming, but there's also sword play, and there's also magic and items and a story with characters who talk, and you know, and Oath and Felghana is basically the same game, but the camera angle has been pulled up so you have a better perspective on everything. It's not side-scrolling anymore. And it's all been remade so that it's nicer, and they've rebalanced it, and, you know, they've rewritten the story and everything. But I still remember some of the locations and some of the equipment and the story beats from the original game. So it's been weirdly kind of nostalgic for me as well to play through Oath and Felghana. But it's a fantastic game. And I just, even playing this, I keep thinking this, I think Nintendo fans would absolutely love this. It would be wonderful as a 3DS release. Unfortunately, I don't think Falcom likes Nintendo much at all. The last game they released on any Nintendo system that I know of was back then.
Yeah, I don't think that Falcom really likes any systems beyond the PC and the PSP, really.
Yeah, and this game is available on PSP as well as PC.
Yeah, but what I mean is, I think that the ones that did develop themselves were always for the PC. They let other people port their stuff. So who knows? Maybe there's a chance.
That's true. Yeah, maybe some enterprising Nintendo developer will license it and make a version for the fans, because this is a perfect fit, you know. And unfortunately, because of the platforms that it is on, I think a lot of Nintendo fans will never get to play it. And if they did, they would love it, because it has a lot in common with games that you already like. I've just been blown away by it. It has been a long time since I sat down to play a game for 30 minutes and got up 4 hours later and said, oh God, I have to go to bed. I got nothing done tonight. I played a video game from when I got home from work until I had to go to sleep. And that game was Oath and Felghana. So it is, I think it's the real deal. It's really awesome. Okay, so we're going to have to wrap up new business. We had a lot of games we didn't even have time to talk about, unfortunately, but that's the way it always is. So we're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we've got your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
All right, first up this week, we've got a review of Balloon Pop Remix by Neil Ronahan. He says this fourth eShop game by UFO Interactive, a weird cross between the Bejeweled and Puyo Puyo, is their best yet. And we have an editorial by new staff member Justin Berube, The High Barriers to Entry in Competitive Pokemon, in which he details what he thinks are the 6 main reasons why he keeps failing year after year to create a team that stands up to the best.
We have a feature by Danny Bivens, the Japan eShop Roundup for September 5th, and Danny once again rubs it in by talking to us about these awesome games that we'll never get to play, such as for the action RPG, For the Frog the Bell Tolls, made by the same team at Nintendo who brought us Link's Awakening.
For the Frog the Bell Tolls.
That's great.
What an amazing title.
We also have an editorial by Ariel Ruff, seeking 3DS XL protection for long walks on the beach. No, it's not a Craigslist ad. It's just Ariel describing how he warmed up to the oversized 3DS XL, but needs a case to both protect its exterior and hide its ugly colors.
Don't we all?
That's a great title.
Please protect me and hide my ugly colors. All right. We also have an editorial by Danny Bivens, The Great Pre-Wii U Backlog Saga Day 49. He details his experience closing the book on New Super Mario Bros. Wii and GoldenEye before moving on to Kirby's Epic Yarn, keeping a healthy gaming diet by alternating between sickly sweet and gritty games. We also have impressions of Hotel Transylvania by Neil Ronahan. WayForward gives young kids their first Metroidvania, which could be a good or a bad thing depending on your view of raising a new generation to use words like Metroidvania.
I fully support this.
As do I. More Metroidvania, thank you.
They're just Metroid games.
Be sure to go check out all of this great original content and the latest news, videos, screenshots, podcastuses, and forums over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back, everyone. It's time for listener mail. So as always, the email address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. You could have your letter read on the show just like these guys. Billy, would you read the first email, please?
Sure. Jet Pilot writes, I'm curious as to your opinion why some people sink so much time and effort into developing fan games, such as last week's Super Mario Galaxy 2.5, when the cold facts that the result of their hard work will be nothing more than a cease and desist letter from the copyright holder, or most, well, I'm going to add just Nintendo. why don't these obviously talented folks use their abilities to create something original that they can, so that they can be rewarded for their hard work?
I think this is a pretty easy answer. It's because these kinds of projects often attract people who don't trust their own creativity. So they're a lot more comfortable starting with a template of something that is familiar and then stretching it out and adding their own spin to it. And you feel like you can accomplish more and develop ideas more so that you don't have to worry about designing your own engine and creating your own characters and having completely new artwork and music and things like that. So it's a shortcut to getting something that's playable and recognizable and that you can focus on the nitty-gritty of designing the specific challenges. And I can speak from experience. When I was a teenager and I was learning to program, I started with a TI-82 calculator, and the first video game that I made, I only made like four ever.
But it was called Boobs?
No. No, the 82 is a programming calculator. It's a graphing calculator. And although it doesn't do much graphics, it's mostly text-based.
It was Boobs Math.
Dude, it was Boobs 2, the sequel to Boobs.
I wrote a quadratic equation that mapped out a picture of boobs on the XY coordinate system. No, actually, my first game that I developed was called Zork. And Zork is an old PC game that I had barely played. I knew of it. I had seen it before. It's a text adventure. There's no graphics at all. I'm sure you are familiar with it, Billy. And I am, as well, Johnny.
Don't trust me, my age.
Yeah, yep. I'm not the only old person here.
All right. it was a really popular series, and I liked the idea of it, even though it was too hard for me. So the first game I created was, I remembered the first scene being like you're outside of this weird creepy house, you know, and you go inside,
a
you start exploring
the endless stare, if you will.
Go north, go west.
Exactly.
You were eaten by a lurking Gru.
All right, turn this piece of shit off because I don't know what the hell to do with this game.
Yeah, so the first game that I made for my TI-82 calculator was my version of Zork. I started from that point, and then everything else I just made up on my own. But the way of playing it, the basically typing in, in my case, I was selecting from a menu because I didn't have a text parser like you need for a real text adventure. But you were just choosing from a menu. So it was like push one to go north, push two to go south, push three to pick up the torch or whatever. And you had an inventory and you're solving puzzles and there was a secret ending and a bad ending. And all these things are basically out of Zork, but I didn't have to invent the universe in order to make my first game. I started from an idea that was familiar and that I could grasp. And then I built it out myself, and I learned so much from that experience that I ended up making Zork 2 and Zork 3, and they were completely original and went way, way off from the original inspiration. But that was my entry point. I think it's the same way with these people. I think they want to have the experience, and even if they never finish this project, if they get some nasty letter from Nintendo's legal department saying, you can't do this, you have to stop right now, it's not like that time was wasted. Because they had this experience of working with the team and they got to work on a Mario game. Maybe they did it illegitimately, but still they had that experience, and you can take that and show whatever you did to an employer and parlay that into some kind of career.
Yeah, I mean, making a game is still making a game, regardless of whether or not it's your own game or, you know, something different.
Or just modifying someone else's game, which tons of people have done and very successfully.
I think you can learn a lot about level design that way, too. I mean, if I was going to hand in a portfolio for level design, I think that would be a good possibility, but it also shows your lack of creativity, too, I think, you know, depending what you're inventing along the way, you know.
So, Guillaume, you're learning HTML right now, correct?
I should be. I haven't been a good student, but yeah, sure.
Well, when I first tried learning HTML, I started out by finding some website that was sort of giving lessons or something. And I just had the damnedest time, and I didn't understand what these tags were for. I didn't understand the order that they went in or why you would even use this. And then finally, I realized that you can just right click on any web page and look at the source code.
Yeah.
And from looking at the existing HTML, you can sort of figure out why is this thing here and what does it do? And then you can look at the final product and say, oh, I see how that translates into what I see in the final web page. And so I always tell people, I mean, I've taught computer programming. I taught Fortran, and I always tell people it's so much easier to start with a code and modify it. And you will learn so much from that, because starting with a blank page is the most difficult way to create anything. And it's a good thing to do eventually, but you have to work up to it. And for your first time, I think you should absolutely start with someone else's work and just tweak it. Just make your own version of it. Just change one little thing, and you will learn so much so quickly that way. And that's what these people are doing. There's nothing wrong with it. You know, if they get in trouble, they get in trouble. If they have to stop, they have to stop. But I think I completely understand why they're doing this.
And I, you know, as far as the cease and desist part of the letter goes, is it just me, or is Nintendo not as cease and desist happy as some other companies could be? I mean, they will protect some of their IPs very ferociously, but then you've got things like Super Mario Crossover, this Flash game that's basically Mario levels, but with, he integrates the guy from Contra, or, you know, like the character from Ninja Gaiden, and you play these Mario levels as these characters with their abilities, which completely changes the game. But still, the basic building blocks are, you know, stolen from Nintendo games. That's been around forever, and I don't think Nintendo made a peep about it.
Yeah, and Nintendo seems a lot more concerned with actual piracy rather than just hacking up what's already there.
As they should be.
Yeah, because that's where they really lose a ton of money. Yeah. Not these guys hacking up existing code.
Man, and the thing about Galaxy 2.5, you have to own Galaxy 2 to even play that.
Yeah.
So it's really not destructive to Nintendo's bottom line at all. If anything, it might actually get some people to buy Mario Galaxy 2. I doubt it, but it's possible.
If it took money out of Nintendo's pockets, they'd be up their asses.
Yeah, but it doesn't. So I'm really glad that they seem to just be turning the other way. You know, it's good on them. They should. I'm really happy about that. And we've seen a lot of these kind of projects shut down over the years. We saw the Chrono Trigger 3D remake, which looked really cool, and unfortunately that was shut down. But again, I mean, those people made a very memorable project. They made some really cool videos, and I'm sure they learned a ton. And I bet a lot of the people who worked on that are in the industry right now.
And it's not like with that particular project that they shut it down and then never actually re-released Chrono Trigger. I mean, it was released across a ton of platforms, and that's why they shut that project down. So,
yeah, good point. Okay, so Guillaume has the next letter.
All right. Henry writes, "Do you believe there is a Nintendo conspiracy in the main gaming media outlets against Nintendo?"
We've discussed this on the show before, or at least some version of this question, and at first I didn't want to revisit it, but I thought since we have Billy on the show, it'd be interesting to hear. I'm not asking you to name names, Billy, but you ran EGM, you worked at G4, you worked at Game Informer. You have a lot of professional experience working with other people who maybe aren't diehard Nintendo fans the way we all are. So I wanted to hear if you've what's the gist that you hear from people.
You know, we used to get this question a lot. I think at all of the places that I worked, you guys don't like Nintendo, you're not covering Nintendo. And it's well, A, we did cover everything Nintendo for mainly the main, I would say at least mainly the main things. Like, I didn't, this is before, you know, download games or re-releases or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But for the most part, we covered Nintendo like, just like every other major outlet. If there was news about it, Nintendo, we'd cover it. But, like, since Nintendo only releases news and information so sparsely, it seemed to the masses like, oh, you just don't care about Nintendo. It's like, no, Nintendo's not saying anything.
Yeah.
I mean, look at it now where NCL or NOA, they're releasing all of their own information, like, internally. That's, like, all of the Iwata Asks things and the Nintendo Directs. I mean, that's where all the information's really coming from now. It's so bizarre. Like, you know,
but do you think that media outlets harbor resentment towards Nintendo for that, and in the way that Nintendo isn't necessarily catering to them like other companies do?
I don't think any harboring resentment. I think it's just, it's, I mean, for me as somebody who's run outlets, even when I ran Planet GameCube, it's frustrating. You know, you want to get more information. You want certain questions asked. You can't tell me it's not frustrating for everybody that listens to this podcast that they don't know what the hell, how much the Wii U costs and when it's coming out. And we are moments away from launch. I mean, that's frustrating for everybody. You know, they didn't show new builds at PAX. That's frustrating for me. I wanted to be able to explain that on Nintendo World Report about more about Paper Mario. And I couldn't. You know, but that's the way Nintendo operates. I mean, granted, I'm different. I've been covering Nintendo for a very long time. I'm jaded. Okay. You know, I think anybody that knows me knows that I have this love-hate relationship with Nintendo, you know, and I do it a lot just jokingly because a lot of my friends, you know me as, you know, as somebody who ran a Nintendo site, and I'm still friends with all you guys, and, like, you know, we joke a lot on Twitter and Facebook. That's just me, you know, so, but I don't think outlets are like, we hate Nintendo. Like, I honestly do not think that, you know, there is this Nintendo conspiracy. I think outlets report on it when they can and when there's new information. I also believe, especially now, since there's so much, so many games in the eShop and WiiWare, et cetera, that when it comes, push comes to shove, when a magazine only has X amount of pages to devote to reviews and previews, they're probably going to hit something that's more higher profile than something like a Fluidity, for example.
Yeah.
So, I mean, hell, I wouldn't have known about Fluidity unless I went to PAX Prime years ago when that was one of the only games that they had that was new there. And it just looked cool. So, but no, I really don't think there's a conspiracy against Nintendo.
You know, I think another part of it is that Nintendo itself doesn't release that many games in a given year. So it's not like you're going to hear about them all the time from people. And neither do Sony or Microsoft. I mean, I think Nintendo releases about the same number of games for their consoles or for their portables that these other companies do. Mm. But the difference is that even when a lot of third-party games just don't even come out on Nintendo platforms, especially the console. And when they do, that's not the version that the third-party publisher will demo at an event. So, you know, the new Assassin's Creed's coming out. All the coverage you've seen about Assassin's Creed 3 is not based on the Wii U version, even though it exists, even though it's out there. Ubisoft just isn't going to show up to any given press event and have that version. And if they do, they're not going to focus on it. They're not going to emphasize it. They're not going to try to get all the people of the press to go play that version. But, hey, make sure you try out the Wii U version. It's really cool. It's got all these special features. That's just not the case. And so you get these outlets who cover all the systems, but they come back from some event and they write all these previews, and they write the previews based on the Xbox and the PlayStation or the PC version because that's the one they played. And that's not their choice. That's the publisher's choice.
There's also, I think, like the echo chamber effect. You know, a lot of journalists, I think, just follow each other on Twitter, and it's very easy to spread the word, like, let's say about an iOS game, because then, like, it's very viral because people just, often these games are free or so cheap that, you know, all the journalists will give it a shot if they've heard about it. But it's a little bit harder, even if the game is only like $5, $6, $7 on the eShop. It's just a little bit harder to convince them to give it a shot in, you know, in that case. And I think, you know, sometimes that virality can benefit a Nintendo game. I think that Scribblenauts, you know, the E3 that was first shown, like, did show that journalists were absolutely willing to give a shot to, like, this weird Nintendo DS game that they had heard about. But, I think, you know, like, you don't get to hear a lot from journalists about Nintendo games because they don't get to hear a lot about Nintendo games from other journalists, in a way.
Interesting. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Oh, well, I also think, too, like, kind of the echo chamber of eye-rolling about Nintendo also. You know, one person makes a comment about Nintendo, then somebody else piles on, and then it turns into this big Nintendo bashing kind of thing. It seems to be kind of chic, but...
I don't really see that. I think you could make that argument for anything on the internet.
Yeah, that's but true. I don't think Nintendo
gets more shit in that regard than anything else.
I don't know. I think they do personally.
I don't disagree with you. I mean, I think some people got a real kick out of giving, you know, crapping all over New Super Mario Bros. 2 in their reviews by saying this game didn't offer anything new, and I was like, really? Did you play all the levels? Because the level design was really cool. Like, I thought they did a lot of really unique and interesting things in the level design. I just don't think there's any big conspiracy. I think people on the internet like to hate things.
Yeah.
And welcome to the internet.
And, you know, like, one last, I think, problem, I suppose, this generation was that it was a little bit harder to be a Nintendo fan, I believe, if you didn't appreciate Wii controls. And so, you know, like, people perhaps love Zelda, but they don't like the controls, so they're probably going to, you know, it's probably going to be easier for them to not give it a shot, you know, like, skip this one and not really talk about it on podcasts. Actually, that's a bad example because everyone talked about it. But, you know, like, there's the smaller games certainly didn't benefit from the fact that there's, you know, some people just won't try Wii games because they abhor the controls.
The Wii was certainly easier to dismiss in that regard as opposed to the PS3 and 360 because, you know, dual analog, everybody knows, everybody kind of gets that. So.
Yeah, but I mean, if you look at the media coverage now of Kinect, I mean, Kinect was a big deal when it first launched. It got a lot of attention. But if you look at the way the gaming media treats Kinect and Kinect games now, it's a lot like they treated Wii games for most of that generation. People don't like motion control. And that's a gross generalization. But a lot of adult members of the media who have to play games all day long do not want to do that with motion control. And there are maybe legitimate reasons why they don't want to, but also it has a certain stigma, and there are a lot of really horrible games that get, you know, clumped up with motion control that makes them even more annoying to play. And I think, I think the way Kinect is treated now shows that it has nothing to do with these games having been released on a Nintendo system. It has everything to do with the fact that they were motion controlled.
Oh, people don't like shitty motion control. Let's be clear on that.
Right.
Well, sometimes, I don't know, like, there was SSX Blur, I think, one of the early games that came out. I think the motion controls were fine. Like, you could manage to get them to work, but...
I know a lot of people who did not like those.
Well, yeah, controls. But I mean, if you didn't know exactly what you were supposed to do, it was hard. Like, it didn't work the way you thought it would, but once you knew how it did work... then they worked fine. But it was a
sloppy port of SSX3 on
Wii.
It
did have some, yeah, it was some sort of remix. But still, yeah. Like, I mean, because the controls were a little bit harder to grasp, like, it was very easy to never really figure out exactly how they were supposed to work and then dismiss the game as, like, wow, this shit is broken. But then people got home and they read on, you know, some message board, like, okay, like, you really have to hold it like this. And they try it, it works, and then, you know, like, they dismiss the reviewer's opinion as, you know, like, bias.
Yeah, but, I mean, Billy has a great point. That game wasn't really original content. And that's the other thing about members of the media... And we've done this as well on things like Batman or whatever. you know, if a game's already come out and we've already played it, we're not really interested in playing it on a new system, whether that's Nintendo or not.
Unless it's an HD remake.
In some cases, yeah. But, like, how much did you ever hear about Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 2X for Xbox? Like, it was a remix of a game that was already, like, a year or two old. Nobody gave a shit. You know, I don't think it matters what platform that comes out on. If it's a game we've already played, we've already played it. We're not going to be, we might have to play it for our job. We might be assigned to play a game that we've already played before, but we're not going to be all that thrilled about it. So, I think that has a lot to do with it. And more often than not, when games come out late in some weird version that's maybe not as good, or it's just, it just doesn't add that much to it, a lot of times that seems to be on a Nintendo system.
Maybe that game was not the best example, but you do get what I mean, right? Like, there were some games that did a poor job at explaining to the player how it was controlled. But once you knew, the controls were fine. And it would have been easy, I think, for a reviewer pressed for time trying to get his review done to just completely miss a whole big aspect of, you know, the controls.
And I don't think it's just the controls, the lack of online, the lack of HD. I mean, there's a lot of lacks that you could tack on there on why, you know, when you're going to talk about Madden, you're not going to talk about the Wii version, or when you're talking about, you know, a specific, like, Call of Duty, you're not going to talk about the Wii version. I mean, you might
in a special
column. I know Game Informer did, you know, they would do things, they would have, I forget what they called it, but it was, you know, they basically had something for the Wii port, you know. So, and they would mention, you know, how the controls function, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know if they still do that, but.
Yeah, and there were a few cases where the Wii version was the best, but those were the exception.
There's not too many ports, you know, unless it's a Call of Duty or a Madden that, you know,
right,
launch alongside anymore, because third parties got the hell out of the way.
Yeah, Wii was the worst console I think I've seen for people reviewing games for not what it was, but what it wasn't. So, but that's kind of a side issue, but
I think, you know, that all these, you know, lacks that the Wii, well, how do you say that? All these things that the Wii lacked, I think it affected the multi-console games more than it did the rare, I suppose, you know, third-party exclusives.
Sure.
Right.
So I don't think it would affect the reviews for those all that much. Unless, like, it was clear that a game was, oh, like, this should have been online. But so many of the more beloved third-party games for the Wii were actually single-player.
Well, I mean, just a lot. What I mean is, a lot of the reviews I used to read were like, you know, pretty much comparing the Wii up against the 360 and comparing and, you know, saying that, of course, you know, the game isn't, it's not looking as good, and this, you know, it's, there's no online. Well, of course. I mean, none of that stuff is on the Wii. It's like, review it as a Wii game. Don't review it directly compared to the 360 game, because it can't obviously compete with that.
Well, this is a particular problem when you have the same person reviewing multiple versions of the game.
Yeah.
So on one hand, you could say, well, that's valuable to the reader, because then they know which version is the best, because you've got one person who can make that legitimate comparison. But on the other hand, if the versions are so different, which was usually the case with a Wii port that was really made by a different team, has a completely different feature set, different graphics engine, whatever, but they would still have the same person review it and the HD versions. And then this person is almost forced to make these comparisons that really aren't fair. Like, the guys who were making this version didn't even try to make it comparable. They tried to make it different and unique and something special just for the Wii marketplace, and that worked well with the Wii platform. And you know, in those cases, I think you'd be better off giving it to a completely different person to review. But the nature of gaming media is that you have limited resources, and it's more efficient to have the same person review these multi-platform games.
I think at the end of the day, though, is there a Nintendo conspiracy in the main gaming media against Nintendo? No. Look at next week, everybody and their mother is going to be all over this stuff. Just watch.
Yeah, and they may be critical, but we may be critical. It's up to Nintendo. It depends on what they announce.
Mm-hmm. I'll be critical no matter what.
That's a promise.
The jaded game, right. Really fair camera.
So John's going to read the next letter.
All right, MadX88 writes, I no longer have a Wii, and with anticipation of the launch of Wii U in the fall, I've spent some time building, buying a new library of Wii titles to play on the new console. Thankfully, with the help of your site recommending your site and podcast recommending and thankfully to the helpfulness of your site with recommendations from both the podcast and the forums, and also being a fan of the Xeno series, Xenoblade is on my list. My question to you is, will the Wii U Pro controller support play for Xenoblade, or should I order the Wii Classic controller bundle for Xenoblade off of Nintendo's site?
And certainly you can play Xenoblade on your Wii U. The question is, will you need to get a Classic Controller Pro for Wii to play it and plug that into your Wii U? Or do we think there's a possibility that the new Wii U Pro controller will function as a Classic Controller Pro, but just wireless? And I think, we don't know, but I think there is a strong possibility that that might actually be the case.
Right, like it really depends on whether the emulation is hardware or software, right?
Right. I mean,
because the Wii didn't, the Wii would turn off when you play GameCube games on it. The Wiimote doesn't work anymore, and you can't access the home menu anymore because basically the Wii part is turned off, and all that's left is GameCube hardware.
Right, and 3DS works a similar way when you play a DS game on it.
I think they will allow you to use either the Wii U Controller Pro or the Classic Controller. I think you're going to be able to use both. Nintendo's very good at that sort of stuff.
Yeah. I kind of wonder also, is there a chance you might be able to use the gamepad to play some Wii games where it makes sense? You know, like for instance, Fluidity is a game that you play with the Wii remote held like an NES controller and you just use the tilt. You could totally do that on the gamepad. It has all that functionality. I think it'd be actually almost even better because then it's almost like you're holding a tray, you know, like with water on it and you're trying to balance it. I mean, but regardless, I mean, you could look at it, and it wouldn't work with every game, because some games are definitely made for holding separate controllers in two separate hands, a Wii remote and a nunchuck. But for a number of things, I think you could totally play Wii games on the gamepad without really doing a lot of crazy finagling, including stuff that supported Classic Controller, because the gamepad is sort of a giant version of the Classic Controller. I mean, it has all the same buttons. So this would take a little bit of extra effort from Nintendo, but I think it would be really nice. You know, I certainly would love to be able to play some of my favorite Wii games on the Wii U without having to drag out a Classic Controller Pro, for instance. You know, if I can use the new Pro controller for Wii U that does all the same things, but it's wireless and it weighs less and it's cool, I'd love to do that. So I hope they'll let us.
Hopefully we'll find out next week.
Yeah, because we still don't know much at all about backwards compatibility. We don't know about how Virtual Console is going to work. That's a huge question for me that I'm looking for from this big announcement. So
did I imagine this, or did early when they showed the Wii U for the first time, did they say that the Wii games would not be upscaled?
I think they did say that.
Yeah. So I think that's one clue maybe that they're not willing to put the extra effort.
It could just be that it doesn't have enough power to do it, or they couldn't do it consistently without creating a bunch of bugs.
Right, right. I'm just saying, like, it might be also a sign that the Wii U hardware turns off, and the Wii is just, you know, what's left playing when you play a Wii game.
Possibly. It's a good point. So we'll find out very soon, but it's a legitimate question for sure. So the last question this week is from Nate Dog. Nate Dog writes, I've noticed the Nate Dog
from back from the grave.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Regulate.
writing from the beyond.
Dude, this podcast has got some clout if we're
Seriously.
Bringing people back from the grave.
I've noticed that Japanese games tend to have far more boss fights than games that are developed in the West, or so it seems that way. Maybe it has more to do with the genre of game. Do you find that bosses show up more frequently in RPGs, platformers, especially 2D, and on-rails type arcade shooters than, say, puzzle-heavy games, third-person adventure games, or first-person shooters? Do you generally love boss battles or hate them? I like them only when they aren't drawn out or if there aren't too many of them. I'm finding myself wanting fewer boss battles in a game, maybe just one or two, and wanting the developer to spend more time making a level or world more challenging and immersive. What do you guys think?
I love bosses. But it really depends. I think, perhaps there is, you know, like a difference between Western and Eastern games that way, that the Japanese have more bosses. It seems to me that at some point, you know, Western game did used to have bosses. Like, you would fight an end boss in Wolfenstein 3D, Doom, and Quake.
But they were usually awful.
And Half-Life 1, the first Half-Life. Yeah, but, yeah, and usually, let's just say they weren't really good. And I want to say maybe it was Half-Life 2 that kind of switched that. I'm not sure. Like, I didn't follow the evolution of the FPS all that closely. But there was a point, I think, where critics were raving that probably Half-Life 2 had, like, this kind of set piece at the end instead of a boss battle.
Yeah, it's like a boss stage, but not a boss fight.
Yeah.
It's not like a single character. I mean, I wonder if this comes out of Japanese culture with, like, giant robot shows and Godzilla and stuff.
Actually,
like that.
Actually, I was thinking about that, because when you watch anime, most of the time it seems to be like boss battle after boss battle.
Iconic in their culture. It's not so much in Western culture, I don't think.
But yeah, but like Uncharted had boss, final boss, Killzone had final boss.
Really bad.
Yeah.
Hey,
well, that's the
you
thing,
remember?
Though. Those games seem to be almost more focused on story. You know?
You think about Halo, it ends with the big climactic. Granted, it wasn't a boss, but say you're driving, you know, the Warthog from point A to point B.
Yeah, that's a set
off.
Piece.
But that's, okay, so like a boss-style set piece. I mean, I think, you know, and it's really tough to answer this question because there's so many different types of games that have bosses in them. But, like, I don't think, granted, there are a lot of Japanese games that have, you know, your traditional shoot at the red thing and it will go away, you know, and then they'll explode. I mean, that's historical up to now. Yeah. I mean, go play Vanquish, for Christ's sake. I mean,
hit the weak point for massive damage. I mean, it's
sure. Yeah. I mean, but I mean, I think they're, you know, what do we all think of boss battles? We like them when they're good.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, look at Shadow of the Colossus. It's all freaking bosses. That's awesome.
And they're most of them are really good. There's a couple that are frustrating, but
true.
I find in my older age, I have less and less patience for boss battles because a lot of times it feels like it's almost like a kind of padding. It's like you're kind of doing the same thing you were before, but now it just takes longer because the guy just takes more damage.
I think that's more of a problem in FPS games. I really do think that the genre
It's a big problem in RPGs, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Xenoblade is horrible about this.
Yeah, I agree. But I mean, with like third-person action games, I don't think that people really, you know, like people usually have a good opinion of God of War bosses. Or you look at treasure games, like, aren't they, like, most of the time, like, aren't the bosses kind of the point of the game and the levels between them or the padding, actually?
Yeah, they're like shoot-em-ups in that sense. Like, vertical shoot-em-ups are the same way.
Yeah, it just seems like, in the West, like, the story dictates what the bosses are like, whereas in Japan, they lay the bosses down and then make the story fit into that.
Make the rest of the game fit into that sometimes.
Yeah.
I think that perhaps shooters are a little bit less boss friendly because, like you're shooting dudes the whole time. And what are you going to do at the end? You're going to shoot some dude. He's just going to be harder to kill.
Yeah, big bullet sponge.
Right. It's very, very hard to design a good boss in a first person shooter.
Yeah.
And it's almost never done well.
But then you've got shooters like Resident Evil 4 that do a pretty stellar job, I think.
Yeah.
What about
in that game.
Metroid Prime.
Yes.
Yep. That's, absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
One of the rare exceptions, yes. Fantastic bosses in Metroid and all the Metroid Prime games. And I think Metroid Prime actually does a really nice job of this, but what I look for in a boss battle, and usually my favorite bosses, are ones where they use the level to sort of train you. And so they teach you these mechanics or these certain kind of puzzle approaches, ways to use the abilities you have. And then the boss is not asking you to do something you've never done before. It's just sort of asking you to integrate everything you've learned and put it all together and execute on it. It's like a test.
Yes.
It's like you've been doing your homework. Now here's the test. We're going to see what you really learned. And those are so satisfying when they pull it off and when you play the level. If you were paying attention and you really learned what you needed to learn playing through the level, you get to that boss and you're like, dude, I can totally handle this. And you put all the pieces in the right slots and it just works and it feels awesome. I love that.
Yeah, I can't stand bosses where, you know, you finally reach them and you can just pretty much beat them with one attack. When you have all of these attacks, you know, in your arsenal, but really, he just really needs one to be beat. That's just so disappointing.
Or they add a whole new different layer and go against everything that Johnny just said.
Yep.
And it's like, all of a sudden, here's a new mechanic that you haven't used anywhere else in the whole freaking game.
And you don't have, that's no way to learn how to do something is during a boss fight. When there's all this pressure and you can die easily and you're going to have to replay certain parts over and over because it's difficult. That is not a good training ground for you to learn to do something that you haven't done before.
Yep.
And a lot of games try to do that, and it's a really bad idea.
There's a recent Nintendo release that does that, which I won't make a comment on, but it happens. It's frustrating because it happens so often, you know, like, especially when it's a tentpole release that all of a sudden now it's a fighting game, when really I was just playing a totally different game and it's a fighting game. Like, I'm not going to spoil which game that is, but
I know the one you're talking about and I hated it. It really,
that's a major release and you're like, holy shit, really?
Yeah.
Like, that's how this is going out, like, and you know, but,
and it's hard.
But I do, Johnny. I totally agree with you. When it's basically you learn throughout the game all these different mechanics, and they put a majority, you know, either all of them or a majority of them together, and that's how the game. It's just, that's satisfying, and then you're like, hell yeah, credits. You know, like, let's, you know, this is awesome. Like, it's a good way to go out instead of introducing something totally crazy and different just for your cheap way to get out of the game,
right,
to finish it, you know?
And I really like, I like boss battles, but sometimes set pieces can be integrated in such a clever way and can really improve a game. I mean, like, last week we complained about New Super Mario Brothers bosses, or bosses in Mario games in general, but I think we all agree that the New Super Mario Brothers Wii and the Super Mario 3D Land bosses, like the last bosses, were actually pretty cool, and they were not actually boss fights. They were set pieces, but
yeah,
they were scenes.
Yep.
Yeah, they were all about the platforming, what you've been doing
right,
all this time, but they were impressive, you know, like very epic. I'm sorry to use that word, and you know, but they made sense within the context of the game, and I don't really know anyone who hated them.
And it felt like you were doing things you'd been doing all along, but now you just had to do them really well, and you had to chain it all together and just pull it off. It's like, this is your chance to show what you've learned for
the entire
game. Yeah,
you really have to execute.
Game.
Yep.
Good. That's the problem. That's the reason I don't like most bosses in Mario games, because they're essentially combat arenas, and Mario's not about combat. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you lock me in this room, and all of a sudden it's like, instead of running around and jumping on platforms and swimming and doing all this awesome coin collecting stuff, now we're going to lock you in this room and make you fight this guy to the death. That's not what Mario's about. You know, I think the original Super Mario Brothers had it right. They put you in here and they said, there's no way you're going to defeat this guy. You cannot jump on his head. You're not going to defeat this guy in Mortal Kombat. You're going to have to outmaneuver him. And that is a legitimate way to use the Super Mario mechanics. And it's challenging and it's stressful and it's fun. And it doesn't have to be this really drawn out experience. A lot of those early Bowser fights in Mario, you can beat in 2 seconds if you just do your timing correctly. But it's not trivial. And it's a very memorable way to do it. And it doesn't feel like all of a sudden they're asking you to do something totally different that the game's not good at.
Yep.
That's good stuff. So, hey, what a great four-pack of emails there. We got through them really fast. So it's perfect because Billy's got to go. So I'll wrap up the show right now. You can send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com or click on the link in the show notes, and we'll have a form for you to fill out. And that works just the same way. You can also like Radio Free Nintendo on Facebook and get midweek updates and you'll be the first to know whenever a new episode goes out. It's a really good thing to do to keep in touch with the show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. I am at Johnny Metz. Guillaume is
Pandarius NWR.
John is
Mr. Diamond J, MR Diamond, the letter J.
And Billy is
I am at Louis the Cat.
Perfect. And as Guillaume mentioned earlier, we do still sell t-shirts, and they're really cool. There's a lot of different designs to pick from, and we have a brand new banner on the front page of NintendoWorldReport.com to show off the very cool Radio Free Nintendo and connectivity t-shirts. If you haven't been over to look at those in a while, I would really recommend you do so. It's a great way to support the website and the podcasts. And thanks to everybody who has already done so. Thank you very much, Billy, for being here and substituting for James. You were wonderful, as always, sir.
Yeah, thanks, guys. It was a lot of fun. And go to the site and check out my extensive Paper Mario preview from PAX. And
Fluidity, too.
And yeah, but definitely check out Fluidity. And I plug that game. The first one, try it out. I don't even remember how much it was. I don't think it was that much.
It's like 10 bucks. Or 12 bucks.
I think it was 12.
It's a big game. I played it for 20 hours.
It's worth it. It's really good.
It's a good value. Yeah. It's awesome.
I'm psyched for the new one. I think it'll be great. So check out those previews, please.
Excellent. Yeah. Thank you so much for being our roving correspondent, Billy. That was awesome.
Yeah.
It's exciting to see your name on the website. Next week, we expect to be talking about the Wii U launch announcements, because it's happening the day we record, and I'm sure we'll have a lot to say about it. So look forward to that next week. I think James will be back. And finally, I want to pimp a really, really cool thing that I got to participate in as a bonus segment on Connectivity Episode 49. Scott Thompson and I answered your questions about space. It was the first time I've ever talked about space on a podcast, or really written very much at all about it on the internet. And it was really fun, and I hope to do it again sometime. So if you're interested in space, human space flight, we talked about Neil Armstrong and a lot of other really cool things going on in the world of space right now. I hope you will go check it out. It's on Connectivity Episode 49, and this week you're going to hear Episode 50, and I don't know what they've got planned, but I know it's big. So if you're not already subscribed to Connectivity, go do that right now. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye. Later. Hey, didn't fight with anyone.
I'm still friends with all you guys, and we joke a lot on Twitter and Facebook. That's just me, but I don't think outlets are like, we hate Nintendo. Like, are you sawing wood?
Again?
Is that your fridge?
It is my fridge.
Yeah, it sounds like wood in the background.
It really does.
Hold on, I need some more 2x4s.
Dio, pass me my protective glasses. Thanks, man. I'm going in.
Let's ignore it. It's going to be cleaned up. Don't worry.
All right, guys.
I didn't get to tell the haters of New Super Mario Brothers because, seriously, that game is awesome.
I agree.
If you're still recording, then maybe you just made the stinger.